Can you hear me?
It's to your right.
It's this one. Oh, great. So you can hear me now, right? Okay, well, we put the talks in order because in some respects, some of them, one follows from the next. So Dr. Grant has very nicely set up for you some of the major issues, including what is perhaps the largest change that we're planning to make in the DSM-5 substance use disorders, which is to remove the distinction between abuse and dependence and combine most of the symptoms, or we considered all of the symptoms together into one disorder. And she's shown you evidence for the fact that, that if you put those symptoms, if you put those criteria together, it's unidimensional across different substances. And what may not have come out so clearly from her slides, but which are also there, is that abuse and dependence are interspersed across the severity spectrum. So it's not like the abuse criteria are all mild and the dependence criteria are all severe, but they're interspersed with each other. So what I'm going to do is use that as a starting point for three of the issues that we've also considered and some of the evidence for what we decided. So there was some interest in thinking about whether some of the criteria could be removed because it's starting to get to be a longish criteria list, and whether there were some important ones out there that weren't included that we could think about adding. And then we also considered whether nicotine disorders could be lined up with the other substance disorders. So I'm going to go through each one of those in turn. Let's see if I can. Okay, great. So legal problems are obviously a serious problem for some substance abusers, but the question we asked is, should these really be a criterion for substance use disorders? Some of the concerns about dropping it that clinicians had was that it might be the only thing that some clients or patients will admit, or the only thing that qualifies them for reimbursement. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about the background of the criterion and studies and clinical samples. So the legal problems, the DSM-IV criterion, it's important to understand, are about being arrested or held at the police station or any other legal problems because of substance use. Okay, so this is behavior that's associated with use, not simple possession. So some people have been concerned about the criterion or its removal because of changes in laws and enforcement, which certainly are variable across time and place. But this criterion is really related to behavior associated with use. So when we look back over the studies that had been done in clinical samples, where most of the concerns seemed to be coming from in terms of dropping it, we found that there was actually surprisingly little evidence about whether how legal problems went with the rest of the criteria. Either it wasn't evaluated separately from the other criteria, or it was and the findings were inconsistent. In the general population, it was found in several different papers that legal problems had quite low loadings, factor loadings, with other criteria. That's true for alcohol in two separate studies, for cannabis in a paper by Wilson Compton and co-authors, and then in three substances from a paper that's in press now from Dr. Grant's group on showing the same thing for amphetamines, cocaine, and non-medical prescription drugs. So we decided to take another look at this in a clinical sample, since this was where a lot of the concern was coming from, and see how legal problems functioned relative to the other criteria. So what we did when we did that was we first looked at the overall prevalence, and we found similar to the general population that legal problems were very infrequent, that they had relatively low factor loadings compared to some of the other criteria when you put them all together. And here are the IRT curves that are similar to what Dr. Grant showed you. And legal problems, do I get the arrow here? Yep. They have a very kind of flat slope, generally speaking, which shows they're not very discriminating, and they're also quite severe from the place they appear on the severity spectrum. Remember, as you move over towards the right, that means a more severe criterion. So this is what we got for alcohol in over 500 patients in treatment for alcohol disorders. This is what we got for cannabis in the same sample amongst cannabis users, an almost flat line. For cocaine, the same thing. And for heroin, pretty much the same thing. And then we were wondering if we would lose some patients by dropping this criterion in this clinical sample. So we looked at keeping a threshold of 2 or more, which is the threshold that we've more or less decided upon for the substance use disorder criteria. And we wanted to see how many patients we would lose from making a diagnosis if we removed legal problems from the list. And this is what we found for alcohol, for cannabis, for cocaine, and for heroin. So the thing is that if patients or clients or residents in the general population are going to have legal problems, the chances are that they're going to have so many of the other criteria that they get a diagnosis anyway. You don't lose them from the diagnostic net, so to speak, if you drop that one. So the conclusion that we've come to based on all this evidence is that it really makes sense to drop legal problems from the list of criteria, although for specific studies that are interested in legal problems specifically, of course, would have to be assessed. Okay, what about craving? Craving is a serious problem for some substance abusers, obviously. And then we ask the question, should it be a criterion for substance use disorders? So some of the reasons for adding craving is that it's already a dependence criterion in ICD-10 and it presumably will be retained in ICD-11. That's the international set of diagnostic criteria. Additional reasons for considering craving are that it's a promising target for pharmaceutical intervention, it seems to have a neural basis, and a number of other types of studies that have been done with it. So the questions we asked were, how does craving work psychometrically with the other DSM-5 criteria? Is it unidimensional with them? Does it have reasonable severity and discrimination? And does it add information to the existing criteria set? So we look back at the earlier studies again, and there wasn't that much information from clinical samples, and so we looked for other sources of data. So the first place we found data was a survey that Dr. Grant organized now quite a number of years ago that did include craving in the questionnaire. So this was over 42,000 people in the general population with oversampling for different ethnic groups. And there were 2 craving items for alcohol. Have you ever wanted to drink so badly you couldn't think of anything else? That's the first one we looked at. And this is the IRT curve that includes that. And so as you can see, with this wording, it's a fairly severe criterion, and it fits in very nicely with the rest of the criteria. It's unidimensional with them. And then there was an alternative craving item, which was milder in terms of what it assessed, but it actually is more consistent with what's in ICD-10 right now, which is, have you ever felt a strong desire or urge to drink? So here's the corresponding IRT analysis for the criteria with this somewhat milder wording. And so as you can see, it fits in nicely with similar discrimination. It's just a little bit closer to the left, so it's a little bit less severe. So that's for alcohol. And then we looked at it again for cannabis and cocaine use disorders, and that in the survey, only the milder question was included that we could analyze. And here you see it comes out with very similar results for cannabis and for cocaine. So looking again in the clinical sample to see if it checked out similarly, we saw that craving was pretty common among these clinical patients, as you might expect in this sample where the overall mean for the severity of the disorder is considerably increased compared to general population. And that cravings had very high factor loadings on the latent trait underlying all the criteria. And it's hard to see in this slide, but there is a blue line in there. Let's see if I can get the arrow to come back. Not so easily. It's not a very cooperative arrow. But anyway, close to the left, there's a kind of blue line, and that shows that craving fits in very nicely with the rest of them. It's not that severe. Same thing, that was for alcohol. This is for marijuana, for cocaine, and for heroin. And then we looked at whether the adding craving and adding actually the abuse criteria also would add significantly to the information over just that provided by this set of dependence criteria. So for alcohol, we actually found that just adding craving alone to dependence criteria didn't significantly increase the information, but adding the abuse criteria, the three, not including legal, did, and then of course adding, putting dependence, abuse, and craving did seem to offer a more informative set of diagnostic criteria. For marijuana, when you put them all together, it results in a more informative set of criteria. For cocaine, we actually found that the dependence criteria worked best. It seemed like the adding the other ones seemed to be a sort of cluttering of the criteria. So this needs another look in different samples. And then this is what we got for heroin. It's a lot like what we got for cannabis. When you add abuse and craving, you get a more informative set of diagnostic criteria. So the cons of adding craving are that it's not included in all existing data sets, somewhat sensitive to wording item, it adds information sometimes but not consistently. At the same time, the pros are that it is very unidimensional with the existing criteria. The SUD structure is unimpaired when you add craving. It aligns DSM-5 with ICD-10, and it, perhaps most importantly, it's been enthusiastically received by many clinicians. And so the conclusion has been to add craving to the diagnostic criteria. So finally, I'm going to deal with the nicotine use disorders. In DSM-4, there's only criteria for dependence and not for abuse. This was because 25 or so years ago, expert opinion was that the abuse criteria just didn't apply to nicotine. But things have been changing around cigarettes and nicotine over the last 2.5 decades, so the picture might be different today. And regarding craving, nicotine experts are very interested in this diagnostic criterion. So in terms of location of information on this, there are not any U.S. sources that we've been able to identify so far, because without putting the criteria in the diagnostic manual DSM-4, people didn't assess them. But there was a source of information on this from a study that I'm actually principal investigator on in Israel. So we interviewed 1,349 participants with NIAAA and NIDA funding. This is what we got for alcohol, just to reassure that this is a reasonable setting in which to do the research. We did an IRT analysis for alcohol abuse and dependence, and it came out very similar to how it came out in all the other settings. So we looked at the new proposed criteria for nicotine disorders that would align them with the criteria for the other substance use disorders. We looked at the factor structure, and then we looked at the criteria individually and as a set against a set of external validators. This is how we operationalized the abuse criteria. Social and interpersonal is continuing to smoke even though it made other people like family members angry or unhappy. Hazardous use was smoking in a situation that increased the chances of getting hurt. And neglecting roles is finding that your smoking interfered with major roles. This is what the IRT analysis came out looking like. Again, very, very, very similar to what all the other substance use disorders looked like. These were the total information curves that we generated, and it showed that adding abuse and craving provided a more informative data set. And then for the validation, we looked at 10 validators, including smoking first thing after awakening in the morning, waking up during the night to smoke, amount of smoking, smoking even when ill, quite an extensive list. We felt that it would be important to spread as wide a net as possible on the validators. And this slide shows the associations in terms of odds ratios between each of the criteria and the validators, which are shown on the x-axis. So each line here is a different color, and that represents a different criterion. So like, for example, the one with the highest point, it's hard to get this pointer to work, but anyway, the point that's very high for the daily smoker is withdrawal, as an example, is a kind of rusty color. These are the dependence criteria only, and as you can see, there are strong, significant, related, these are all significant, and the point is that they're all fairly strongly associated with all the validators, some of them at the level of odds ratios of 6 or 7. This is the same way of arraying the abuse criteria and craving. So each of the lines represents one of the abuse criteria. against and the associations of that criterion with each of these external validators. Once again, you see these are all significant and they're all fairly strong. And so just to show the new criteria relative to the old one, this is a black and white illustration of just the dependence criteria. And this is with the abuse criteria and craving superimposed on top of it. So this seems to suggest that they really do function as a group the same way they do for the other substance use disorders. And then we've gone on to test the difference between the full criterion set for DSM-5 relative to DSM-4 nicotine dependence against the validators. And we found that DSM-5 is more strongly associated with them as a set than DSM-4. This is visual representation of some of these results. So in summary, the nicotine abuse dependence and craving criteria are unidimensional. They're structured similarly to the structure of alcohol and drug criteria. Adding them makes a more informative criteria set, and they relate strongly to external correlates of the diagnosis. So our conclusion to date is to align the nicotine disorder criteria with those for the alcohol and drugs.